The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Thank you to Brent Noctegal and Jeremiah Jacques for stepping up to the mic in my absence. As I think it was Jeremiah yesterday who mentioned the Robbers Cave campout, the annual college campout that we have, attended by most of the faculty and all of the students at Herbert W. Armstrong College, I believe. For the headquarters campus in Edmond, Oklahoma. This was the 14th Robbers Cave campout, dating back to 2002. We missed one, I believe, in 2010. So if my count is correct, that's 14 campouts since the start of the college. And, of course, here in the UK, we still call it Robbers Cave. Even though we've bounced around these 2 years, last year we took our camp out up north to Scotland. And then this year we headed west to the edge of Wales, right there on the coast, Brynwen Holiday Park in this little village called Borth. Right there on the coast, as I say, near, I think, the biggest city nearby, which we didn't get into, by the way. Aberystwyth, I believe is how you pronounce the name. In any event, over the course of 4 days, we had a cookout on the beach, a very chilly Saturday evening, and then a game night as well. Did lots of hiking, lots of physical, strenuous physical activity, hiking, dodgeball, soccer. And by the time we got in the car yesterday to drive home, it was actually kind of nice just to sit for a while after taking on more physical activity than I'm usually accustomed to. So it's good to be back. It's good to be behind the mic. And by the way, speaking of Robbers Cave, we settled in, as I said, in this little holiday resort in Borth. And 15 miles away, there was actually a small Robbers Cave located at Devil's Bridge Falls. How's that for a couple of ominous names, Robbers Cave and Devil's Bridge Falls, or Bridge Falls, I think it was. And when we worked our way down through the falls, spectacular a hike, I guess. Not so much a hike, I suppose. It was just a path with lots of steps and such that you could go down and to the bottom of the falls and then cross a bridge over the stream and then head up the other side of the falls. And it was on our the end there, as we were heading back up the mountain, that there's this little cave with a signpost just outside. And sure enough, it said Robbers Cave. And this is what it said on the signpost. It said, this cave's called Robbers Cave because many hundreds of years ago, it was a hideout for three highway robbers. These robbers were the children of a local man. It said, as young children, they were very wicked, and while idly rambling about the woods, one day they came across a small hole in the ground. To their surprise, they had discovered a hidden cave. When they were older, the two young men came back to their secret cave and used it as a place to sleep and store their riches that they had acquired from robbing people. Their sister would visit and bring them food. Occasionally, she would go out at night and steal with her brothers. Well, it goes on and talks about some of their lawless acts and how that they were eventually caught, and the two men were hung, and the young woman was burned at the stake. So some history there, along with what happened back at Robbers Cave in the U.S., this remote location out in the woods with all these caves known to have concealed the legendary Jesse James and a number of other famous outlaws. There in southeast Oklahoma. Well, obviously, that's not the history that makes Robbers Cave so special to us. But rather, it's what happened there over the course of many years. Well, one year in particular, back in July of 1989, is that history there, that history that happened there, and then what's happened since through those 14 campouts for the college in Oklahoma, and now too for the students, the few students that we have over here in the UK. All that's happened over those many years, it's a rich history associated with God's work, with God's college, with God's church. I just want to begin the program by reading a few verses in Daniel 8, this prophecy about 1,150 days. Many of you listeners are very familiar with this, I know. If you're not, you can go onto our website, thetrumpet.com, and search for Daniel Unsealed at Last, and it'll give you a pretty good and thorough explanation of this prophecy. In any event, it says here in Daniel 8, verse 11, yes, he magnified himself even against the prince of the host, and by him the daily was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and an host was given him against the daily sacrifice, or the daily, or the work, by reason of transgression, and it was cast down, or it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced, and it prospered. So this prophecy in Daniel is about an end-time Antiochus, a type of Antiochus ruling inside God's church. It's about a spiritual abomination of desolation. It's about a great destruction that happened to God's work. And how did it happen? Well, verse 13 says, then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spoke, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? How long is this going to go on? This destruction, it's set in because God's people, as it brings out in other passages, they didn't love the truth. They didn't hold on to the truth. And so a leader comes along, a corrupt man, with a corrupt administration supporting him, and he proceeds to just destroy the work in the church. And so many of God's people just went along with it. But God continued to do his work. God raised up another work, led by another man who actually did follow in the footsteps of Herbert Armstrong. Verse 14 says, and he said to me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now you can look in the Revised Standard Version, and it says 2,300 evenings and mornings. In other words, 1,150 days. There were evening sacrifices and morning sacrifices. So two sacrifices per day. You can look into the commentaries yourself to study more about this 1,150-day period, or to have it spelled out, that it's referring to 1,150 days. God here is saying that at the end of 1,150 days, the sanctuary would be cleansed. Now, the question my father poses in his booklet on this prophecy, the Daniel booklet, is when did Satan take away the daily because of sin? And when did the 1,150 days end? Well, the beginning of this time period, we won't take the time to go back to 2 Thessalonians 2. Many of you are very familiar with that prophecy as well. But in 2 Thessalonians 2, it talks about a man being taken out of the way. It also talks about another man, a man of sin, in that passage. And as my father explains in Malachi's message, Herbert Armstrong was taken out of the way. He was the restraining force, or the spirit in him kept back that Laodicean movement, that lukewarm movement. Mr. Armstrong's taken out of the way, and that happened on January 16th, 1986, the day that he died. And through the period after that, I mean, as you know, many of you anyway, the Philadelphia Church of God started on December 7th, 1989, so there was nearly 4 years in between Mr. Armstrong's death and the establishment of the PCG. And after Mr. Armstrong's death, my father's explained this before and talks about it even in some of our literature. A couple of years in, he was actually very enthusiastically supportive of Mr. DeKotch and extended an invitation for Mr. DeKotch. That's the one that Mr. Armstrong appointed to be pastor general in the event of his death. My father extended an invitation to Mr. DeKotch to visit the congregation that he was over there in 1986, 1987. That's Oklahoma City and the Enid congregation north of Oklahoma City. But during this time, as we brought out on this program so often, there were many changes taking place, disturbing changes taking place in the worldwide Church of God, administratively, doctrinally, changes in personnel, changes at Ambassador College. And so after a couple of years, my father finally looked at what was happening and said, well, maybe I'm not looking at this the right way. He was just assuming that while there were disturbing things happening, somehow God would straighten it out and fix it, and he wouldn't have to worry about it. But after about 2 years, he started to say, wait a second. Am I thinking about this the right way? Am I looking at this biblically? And so he started to really dig into God's Word, studying the history of the true church, looking at Revelation 2 and 3. And in the course of that study, he learned and was reminded that the church often goes astray. And once his eyes were really open to that, then God just started to open his mind to so many prophecies, like 2 Thessalonians 2, like the little book of Malachi. Well, it was in that fourth year, leading up to the establishment of the Philadelphia Church of God, that he was working diligently on the cornerstone work of this church, that is Malachi's message to God's church today. Malachi's message to God's church, early in 1989, I was a freshman at Ambassador College out in Pasadena, California, and was in pretty good communication with my father, calling my parents maybe once per week. And it was clear early in 1989 that in some of those phone conversations that he was really disturbed by what was happening in the church. Just to give you a few reminders of what was going on at the time, it was in January of 1989, January 31st to be exact, that the Worldwide Church officially announced that Mystery of the Ages was being removed from circulation, that they were no longer going to distribute Mystery of the Ages. Now, if you go and read Raising the Ruins, you can see there from some of the discovery documents that really it was months before the official announcement that they had already put it on the shelf, quietly. And then finally they came out in January 31st, 1989, and they made the official announcement. And then Mr. DeKotch Sr., he followed that up 2 weeks later in the same publication, the Pastor General's Report, and defended the move. That was in February 14th, 1989. And then in one of my phone conversations with my parents, I was speaking with my dad on February 17th. This was a Friday evening, probably the very day that he received that PGR, with Mr. DeKotch defending the decision to discontinue Mystery of the Ages. And during the course of that conversation, my father said to me, some of the things that ministers are saying today would have gotten them fired if Mr. Armstrong was around. I mean, I couldn't believe it. As a 19-year-old, hearing him say that over the phone, growing up in his house, over the course of my life and seeing just how committed he was to God's work, how supportive he was of Mr. Armstrong, And now he's talking about what some of these ministers at Pasadena and elsewhere were doing, saying that if Mr. Armstrong was still around, they'd be fired. They'd be fired for what they were doing or saying. And then he went on to explain in that same conversation how that Mystery of the Ages was supposedly discontinued for minor errors or they couldn't afford it. That's the way that Mr. Salyer framed it at the time. We know now, of course, that there were other reasons that they discontinued the book. They didn't agree with it. They didn't like it. They rejected its teachings. But in 1989, of course, they were trying to tell people that, well, there's material in other literature that has that discusses the same thing, and it's much cheaper. We're saving a lot of money doing it this way, and so on and so forth. Well, going back to this phone conversation, this is February 17th, 1989. My father said in that conversation that we may very well be in the Laodicean era, the seventh and final era of God's true church. This is something that those in the Worldwide Church of God were very familiar with and talked often about. The prophesied seventh and final era of God's church, characterized by lukewarmness and spiritual blindness. My father told me in that conversation, you better get into Mr. Armstrong's writings and you better study what the prophets of old had to say about in the last days. Well, that was just 3 weeks or so before March 11th, 1989. My father said this at a conference a number of years ago. He said that the message of Malachi's message, the book he wrote, that first book that started the PCG, he said it was in his mind on March 11th. And the reason that date is significant, of course, is because from the time Mr. Armstrong was taken out of the way, January 16th, 1986, if you move forward 1,150 days, it brings you to March 11th, 1989, when God really began to give him the understanding that's now contained in the book, Malachi's Message to God's Church Today. That's when God started to cleanse the sanctuary. That's when God started to raise up the ruins of all of that destruction, all that desolation. Now, you fast forward about 4 months from there, March 1989, I'm finishing up my freshman year at Ambassador College, and then I came home in mid-July 1989 to spend some time with the family for 3 or 4 weeks before then transferring over to Big Sandy, the sister campus of Ambassador College. Big Sandy, Texas, located there in East Texas. Well, on Friday, July 14th, that's when I flew in to Oklahoma from California to spend the rest of my summer at home. My father picked me up at the airport, and we drove from that airport. Instead of going home, we went straight from the airport to Robber's Cave, the same campsite, the same campout, the same state park that we've been now going to for 14 years. And the reason we went there is because my father's congregation sponsored a 5-6 day camp out for many of the Worldwide Church of God congregations there in central Oklahoma, in South Oklahoma, Southwest, Southeast. And it was in the course of that 2-3 hour drive from the Oklahoma City airport to Robber's Cave that my father really unloaded. He unloaded quite a lot of the contents that he had written in this paper, this manuscript, that he hadn't told anyone about, that he worked on secretly. Not even my mother knew about it. He was working on it in his office at home when he could, and he worked on it up in Enid at the office complex that they rented for Sabbath services up there for the small congregation. And by the time July 14th rolled around, he had pretty much most of Malachi's message in his mind, on paper, in fact. He had a manuscript tucked away in his briefcase on that very drive out to the camp out. And so he told me about a number of things that were happening in the church. A few of them I was aware of. Most of it I was not aware of. I was just a teenage student heading into my sophomore year, excited about being at Ambassador College. But he tells me there in the car ride that there's quite a few ministers that were upset by what was happening in the church, disgruntled with all the changes that were coming out of Pasadena nonstop. He said he felt like the church was headed toward a definite split, and that he wanted me to read what he had written about this split, about the Laodicean era, about all these doctrinal changes. And so the thought of doing that, well, it was nerve-wracking. I was scared. I didn't want to read it at first. I wanted to put it off. In fact, I did. We got out to the camp out that afternoon, July 14th, and we had the Friday study, the Sabbath service, and then the end of the camp out was Sunday afternoon. And so by Sunday morning, I finally got around to it and thought, well, he's really fidgety all weekend. He really wants for me to read this. And so I need to go through it. And as I was going through it, let me tell you, it was a real eye-opener. It really did open my eyes to what was happening in the church. But more than that, it showed me what God was doing about it, what God had to say about it. He kept coming in and out of the room, by the way, my father, hoping for feedback. He hadn't gotten any. No one had read anything yet. This was his 4-month project, and this was the first time anyone had laid eyes on this work. I remember telling him that, well, what you've got here is certainly going to get you fired. And he said, I know. I mean, it's serious. What's happening? Let me just read to you what it says over in James. This is another prophecy that really is pretty amazing when you think about God's timetable, when you think about how God follows through and is so precise. We've talked often about the signature prophecy of Herbert Armstrong, what's emerging now out of the heart of Europe. We've talked about the clash between the king of the south and the king of the north. Well, there's a number of other prophecies that maybe we don't talk about as much on this program. Prophecies having to do with God's church. Prophecies having to do with a great falling away from the truth. Prophecies about God raising the ruins. Notice this one right here, James 5, verse 16. It says, confess your faults one to another and pray one for another, that you may be healed. The effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. A righteous man who is effectual and fervent in his prayer life, that really gets results. That's the kind of prayer that Herbert Armstrong had as God's servant. He came in these latter days as one in the spirit and power of the end-time Elijah, or the Elijah of old. You can read about the prophesied Elijah there at the end of Malachi 4 and elsewhere, Matthew 17, of course, Luke 1, quite a few prophecies. And then right here, notice verse 17, it says, Elijah was a man subject to like passions as we are, and he prayed earnestly that it might not rain. And it rained not on the earth by the space of 3 years and 6 months. Now, if you go back into the history there in 1 Kings 17, you read about the original Elijah prophesying about rain and drought. He came along and prophesied this. He didn't pray for it. Here in James, it says he prayed for it. This is referring specifically to the end time Elijah, one who prayed for spiritual rain and drought. In this case, it's talking about Mr. Armstrong praying for it not to rain. Praying for God to cut off the revelation. Obviously, as my father's explained before, he knew. He knew shortly before he died that something was rotten at Pasadena. He knew. And he was old. He was about to die. And so he just prayed to God. He had a strong prayer life. He offered up an effectual, fervent prayer. He saw the rebellion. Think back on all the warnings that he issued, particularly in that last year of his life. As he was saying, there are people like vultures waiting for me to die. Telling the entire church, you don't get it. You don't, and you ministers don't get this. He knew. He knew. But he was right there at the end of his physical life. And so he prayed for God to take care of it. He prayed for God to intervene. Verse 18 says, and he prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth brought forth her fruit. Now, if you think about that 3.5 year period, we know that he died on January 16th, 1986. And then the first person to read Malachi's message, that was me on July 16th, 1989. Now, my father was receiving that truth, that understanding, 4 months before that. But no one had seen it. No one had read it yet. 3.5 years after the death of Herbert Armstrong, 3.5 years of no rain. And then finally, it starts to rain again. And it went from there. I mean, it starts small. It always does. It's a mustard seed beginning with God's work. But from there, I forget how long exactly, a month or two, John Amos, my father's assistant, very disturbed by what was happening in the church, just beside himself. Didn't know why these changes were occurring. Didn't know how God was going to take care of it. My father lets him read Malachi's message, and let me tell you, he was a gung-ho supporter from start to finish of this work of raising the ruins. There were others in the Oklahoma City congregation and Enid, my father's congregations, who were very disturbed, again, by what was happening in Pasadena. They, too, wanted answers. My father put him off for a while, but then finally he let them read what was to later be titled Malachi's Message to God's Church Today. That was going on in the fall of 1989 as I was headed back to Big Sandy, starting my sophomore year at the sister campus, Ambassador College in Big Sandy, Texas. And of course, by this point, I knew all about what my father thought about the direction of the church. Early on, well, actually, if you go back to the start of that year, I arrived at Big Sandy. Mr. DeCotch Sr. was in Big Sandy for the orientation, and this just really set the tone for the entire school year. He was giving an orientation message, talking about all the faults of Mr. Armstrong, criticizing Mr. Armstrong, his work, his teachings. Throughout, he seemed paranoid and defensive. What an odd orientation lecture to give. Here we were at Ambassador College, the college that Herbert Armstrong established. And you have his successor coming in, less than 4 years. And he's running down the founder of Ambassador College. They were becoming more and more outspoken in their criticism of Mr. Armstrong. My family came down to Big Sandy in October of that year for the Feast of Tabernacles. That was when my sister first read Malachi's message. I gave to my father a tape. I had gotten a job at the college library in the the records and archives room, where I had access to all these old tapes by Herbert Armstrong and some of the leading ministers and some of the classes that were offered at Ambassador College, tapes that went back 10, 12, 20, 30 years. And I gave my father a copy of a tape. Actually, that was just from the year before. This would have been the Feast of Tabernacles in 1985, the last feast for Mr. Armstrong when they played the video advertising Mystery of the Ages. So this would have been 4 years earlier from that 1989 feast. And you know the history, some of you do, about all of the special materials they put into the printing and distribution of Mystery of the Ages. Well, anyway, my father used that audio tape and actually pulled a few points from it and put it into his feast sermon in 1989. It was coming to a head, in other words. Because my sister now read it, Mr. Amos read Malachi's message, and then the few that read it from the Oklahoma City and Enid congregations. There were five of them, three men and two wives that came along. And as I say, my father put them off as long as he could, but they were so persistent and they were so distraught that he brought them together in early November 1989. He handed them copies of Malachi's message. He basically summarized some of the key points. He said, "Now I want you to go home and study this, and then we can come back together in a couple of weeks." And at the time, he received a lot of encouragement and relief even from these five who wanted answers, who wanted to know why the church was going off track. But as my father and Mr. Amos left that meeting, my father did wonder. I wonder if I did the right thing there, because you never know what they might do or how they might think tomorrow or what they might talk about on their way home. In any event, a couple weeks later, they came back for a meeting. And, of course, the tone was very different. The tone was very different. The two that brought their wives the previous time, they didn't bring their wives this time. It was just the three men. And they said right away, "We don't agree with what you're saying here in Malachi's message." And so my father, just to give you the short version, he said, "Well, all right, give me the manuscripts and just be assured that in due time, this message is going out to Pasadena." Well, one of the men went from that meeting, contacted the old minister that had been in Oklahoma City before my father arrived in 1985, I think it was. And then that minister immediately called Pasadena, got a hold of Joe DeCotch Jr., and that's what led up to Mr. Amos, John Amos, and my father being called out to Pasadena for that December 7th, 1989 meeting, that four-hour meeting between my father and John Amos and Joseph DeCotch Jr. and Mike Fazell. Now, as it happens, the day of that meeting, Joseph DeCotch Sr. was in Big Sandy, where I was at college. He was out there for a big groundbreaking ceremony. The church, as you know, had been going through massive changes in the late 1980s. Right after Mr. Armstrong died, I mean, one of the final decisions he made was to close Big Sandy and to focus more of the resources on getting a message out to this world. Mr. DeCotch reversed that decision early on. He kept Big Sandy open. He decided to pursue accreditation in 1988. And then in 1989, the end of 1989, he decided to close the Pasadena campus and to consolidate all of the college activities in Big Sandy. Everything was moving to Big Sandy. The focus was going toward Big Sandy. He said this is the end of 1989. This is all going on around the time of my father's firing. Mr. DeCotch said, "Under careful study is also the possibility of moving one or more major departments of the work to Big Sandy, where costs of construction are significantly less than in Pasadena and cost of housing would be considerably more affordable for our employees." And so he went on to say, if God leads me to move some parts of the work or all of it to Big Sandy, to Texas, then so be it. That's what was going on. On December 7th, 1989, he's out there for the groundbreaking ceremony of the new Hall of Administration building, the centerpiece of the campus. Now, a lot of these plans, of course, didn't ever pan out. But it's just interesting in looking back on all of these remarkable events from 1989 and all of these precise and specific prophecies. 3.5 years, 1,150 days, the death of Mr. Armstrong, him being taken out of the way, the emergence of the Laodicean era of God's church, the seventh and final era. And you can add to that, of course, the prophecy in Revelation 12 about Satan being cast down to this earth. That happened at the time of Herbert Armstrong's death. Well, all of these events from 1986 onward, 1989 in particular, and the first reading of Malachi's message right there at Robber's Cave in southeast Oklahoma. But isn't it interesting that at the time of this groundbreaking ceremony that was really meant to begin the process of transferring the headquarters operations from Pasadena to Big Sandy, that on that very day of that groundbreaking ceremony, you have two ministers of the Worldwide Church of God who were out in Pasadena for a four-hour meeting, a four-hour war, you could say. They were fired at the end. But this was the beginning of the Philadelphia Church of God. This was the beginning of the actual organization. I mean, the beginning itself started when God gave the understanding to his servant beginning on March 11th, 1989. And then the rain started July 16th, 1989. And then the firing of my father and John Amos, December 7th, 1989. And the church, of course, was so small, 12 people, $80, I think it was, 81, 82, I forget the exact figure. Nothing. Two unemployed ministers, two fired ministers, four families. But from there, look at what God has done. Look at what God raised up. As the work of distributing Malachi's message to the largest audience possible, people started to respond, and the church grew. I think my father went on to radio in 1992. Television started in 1993. This is just 2-3 years in. Gives you some idea of just how quickly it got off and running, how quickly it was off the ground. In 1997, we started printing Mr. Armstrong's literature, Mystery of the Ages, The Incredible Human Potential, The Missing Dimension in Sex. All the books, all the booklets that the Worldwide Church of God said they didn't want, that they said was riddled with error. Well, if you know anything about that history from 1997 to 2003, you talk about another fascinating story. It's all talked about there in Raising the Ruins. You can secure a free copy of that if you go to thetrumpet.com. All that history, 6 years of litigation, 6 years of this little church using every available resource to fight for Mr. Armstrong's teachings, to fight for God's truth. What other church has done that? You know, there's other churches out there. There's other splinter groups out there that direct their members to this church to get a copy of Mystery of the Ages. Only one group, only one work was willing to fight for the truth. The one that had the mustard seed beginning from 1989. The one with the cornerstone work of Malachi's message to God's church today. Here's why what's happening is happening. Here's how it's prophesied. Here's the solution. Here's what God's doing about it. What other church has given you that from God? There's lots and lots of groups. Well, you know what's happened to the Worldwide Church of God since that time. It goes by a different name today. It's a mere shell of itself. And all these other groups, all these other breakaway organizations. And none of them have what God has given to this church. That's the truth. And you can prove it out. Just look back at some of this history. Look at the miraculous twists and turns of the court case. And the fact that on January 16th, 2003, the Worldwide Church of God called us. This is on the anniversary of Herbert Armstrong's death. And the Worldwide Church of God called us and said, okay, you can have Mystery of the Ages for such and such sum of money. And then the twists and turns after that enabled us to get our hands on all of the discovery documents that they had turned over during the court case. Keeping all those documents, all those materials, so that we could then tell the true story. You heard on yesterday's program how nations even revise history. How common it is for organizations, for churches, to put out propaganda. What happened? Jeremiah Jacques asked yesterday. You'd think it would be just a straightforward response that was very similar from person to person. Well, what actually happened? You're going to get a lot of different versions from a lot of different people, even with something that happened pretty recently. Well, with Raising the Ruins, it's all laid out there, and it's based on all of this discovery, all of these memos, all of these documents, internal documents from the Worldwide Church of God that expose what was happening. It was all discussed there in Malachi's message ahead of time. God prophesied. God said, this is what's happening. There's a man of sin. There's a Joshua who's got a government problem. Well, Raising the Ruins goes back through the documents and proves it all out and shows you the history that was all prophesied in advance right there in Malachi's message to God's church today. God told us what was happening. God told us what would happen. God told us how he would solve the problem. Well, along the lines of the litigation or parallel with it, and the tremendous court case victory in 2003. In the midst of those years, 2001, we started Herbert W. Armstrong College with just 8 students. And then in March 2002, the very first year of our college, the second semester there, we had our first college campout at Robbers Cave State Park in southeast Oklahoma. Rich, rich history. And we told the students all about that history. This was the place that Malachi's message was first distributed, you could say. First read, after the truth had been cast to the ground because of sin, because they didn't love the truth. The rain started again in 1989. And we started a tradition in 2002 that continues to this day. There's lots and lots of history. You go back over those 14 campouts that we've had, I can remember so many messages and discussions and decisions that were made or that were stated at Robber's Cave. That's why that particular campsite is so special to those of us in this church, to those of us associated with God's college. Zechariah 4 and verse 10 says, "For who has despised the day of small things?" Don't despise the day of small beginnings. That's the way it always starts. It starts so incredibly small. Herbert Armstrong wrote in his autobiography, "When the great God, creator and ruler of the vast universe, does something by himself, he demonstrates his supreme power by doing it in a stupendous, awe-inspiring manner. But when it's actually God who's doing something through humans, it must start the smallest. Like the grain of mustard seed, the smallest of herbs, which grows to become the largest. God works through humans, or rather God's works through humans must start the smallest, but they grow and grow and grow until they become the biggest. That's where this work is heading." That's what we have to see. If we're to be people of vision, over the weekend, over my Robber's Cave weekend, I was reading through the early part of the Prophesy Again booklet. My father in that booklet talking about the great commission that we've been given in this church and how it's to extend beyond, even beyond this earth. I mean, we know what's coming at the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of God's kingdom on earth and the wonderful world tomorrow. But then you look beyond this tiny speck in the universe, this one tiny planet, and the trillions of galaxies, and the many, many trillions of stars and planets and suns and moons. Not one bit of it has been created in vain. There's a purpose that God's working out here below. And God wants to expand this vision. He wants to grow the work to where it fills the universe. It's easy to look at God's work today and see it as something that's small and that most people don't notice. But compared to where we were on July 16th, 1989, just one man in a small cabin on a campground called Robber's Cave, and then his son, the first to read Malachi's message to God's church today, and where we've come since that time, what God has done since, raising the ruins. That's a lot that's happened in 26, 27 years almost. Where will God's work be 27 years from now? What about 100 years from now, 2 centuries from now, 3 centuries from now? What about after another 1,000 years? It starts the smallest, like the grain of mustard seed, the smallest of herbs, which grows to become the largest. God's work through humans must start the smallest, but they grow and grow and grow until they become the biggest. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The Edstone Studios are located in the beautiful West Midlands, right in the heart of the UK. We make the live stream available at thetrumpet.com and also at kpcg.fm. Thank you for the emails that keep coming in response to those programs we had last week and also a few there in response to Mr. Nachtigall's program from Monday and Jeremiah Jacques yesterday. Keep sending those in to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. It's good to be back with you, and we'll see you tomorrow.